Accession number 9420, reel 14.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 14. I wonder if you could tell me how exactly you came to be demobilised in May 1920.
Yes, well, it came about, as I say, because of the cessation of the train crew operation, you know, the carrying the troops back and forwards on leave. And with that particular service, because they still went on leave, as you can imagine. But then when it finished, and we were demobilised. I was sent to Perth Fleet, issued with my civilian suit, and I given my option. I shall never forget, as I say, I've got the option of keeping the overcoat if I wanted it, and I did. And I was demobbed, and then came back to what turned out to be another vacuum, because first thing I thought of was getting a job, naturally. And when I tried to get back on the railway, you know, there was no vacancies there. They'd all been snapped up by people who had accepted a demobilisation, because everybody was being demobilised that could be demobilised, and they wanted to do it from an organisation point of view. And there was only my mother that I had as a relative, and I tried to get in the police first, in the Metropolitan Police, and then they told me that was I single or married, and I said single, and they said, oh, you'll have to live in a section house. I said, well, I can't do that, I've got to support my mother. And so I turned that down, and then I went to the city police, because I was 6'2", you see. And I was just the right height for them. I knew being over 6 feet, I'd be all right. And anyway, I had a thorough examination from them and everything until I got to the eyesight test. And then I should never forget, there was a Scottish optician or officer for the city police. He checked my eyes and he said, my God, he said, you're terrible, mon, you know. And I'd never had any doubt about my eyesight, but of course that was the standard you had to reach in the city police, I suppose. And he said, well, you're a splendid specimen, he said, and I'll put it on your record, he said, but he said, your eyes, he said, I'm sorry, I can't pass you. So he wrote across my record in red ink, I should never forget it, splendid specimen. I was very fit, you know. I was all muscle and quite fit and healthy, and I was only 20. I mean, I was just in, you know, prime of life, you might say. And that was what, and being, I suppose, average intelligence and sense of things, I was getting a bit frustrated, you know, to think that after having gone through all that I couldn't get straight away into a job. And I still wanted to go in the police. And I then tried the PLA. And
could you just explain? Port of London?
Port of London Authority and the dock police, you see. And I've got a picture amongst my full uniform and anything and everything. And anyway, after a medical exam, you had to sit for a 6 weeks examination, you know, and learning the drill and all that, the police. And medical examination, they passed my eyesight, and I was, everything was passed. In fact, included in that, which I didn't know in the city police, was to swim 2 lengths of the bars. Well, I was a good swimmer, so that was no problem. And I passed with flying colours, and I went into the PLA. On probation, you go on probation for a year. You're a year's probation, then you were established or otherwise. And anyway, I started on this. Out of that, I had 3 months plain clothes, and the other 6 months that I served was on.
How long was it before you got this job? Because you said you were digging holes just to get your stuff.
That came after this.
Sorry.
You see, when I failed the. I thought I could achieve it otherwise, but anyway. I was all right, and I did. I remember doing beat duty over the Christmas, and I could hear in the Royal Group of Docks, Royal Albert Docks. I'll never forget it, because you could hear the revelry going on in the streets all around. And of course, she was walking up and down the docks, deserted docks, because there was the sheds, and your beat extended from so many sheds onto the next man's beat. You see, and they adjoined one another. And what contributed to my dissatisfaction with it was that there was a sergeant came around, and he'd come out of college, never done any beat duty, and he came out, and this was Christmas night, even, as I say, and he said to me, because he used to come around and check on you, you know, on your duties, you were going around trying the locks on the sheds. And I stopped, and he said, all correct, Sergeant. So he said, oh, by the way, he said, Gilman, he said, you're 2 feet on enemy's territory. And, what I know now to be a supercilious manner, you know, which niggled me after what I'd been through, you know, and I wasn't prepared to take that from that sort of angle from anybody. I said, and I beg your pardon, Sergeant. So he said, you're 2 feet on enemy's territory. He said, that's your boundary, the end of your beat there. And he pointed back about a couple of feet behind me. Actually, you didn't measure it up, but this is the sort of man he was. And I said, oh, well, beg your pardon. I stepped back smartly in a soldier-like manner, you know, onto 2 feet. I said, I am now within my own territory, Sergeant. He said, don't be impertinent. So I said, all right, Sergeant. And that episode was over, and I was restricted. There was no, after the activity of the war, being in a war, you know, looking after yourself as I had to in action, to come across this kind of thing, it just simply didn't meet me at all. And there were several episodes that I didn't enjoy, and to finish, I finished up after 9 months. And result of it was that it was the term of release was that it was temperamental inadaptability that I left as the reason for leaving the force, for the reason of a reference, you know, to any further employment. Quite nice about it and all that, and I left, and I thought myself, oh well, as I got a job fairly quickly considering, it was easy. But then I came up against it. I couldn't get anything anywhere. There was nothing doing locally. There was a job they were of digging up holes in the memorial ground in West Ham, which was then a practice field for the West Ham Football Club, which of course had more or less suspended its activities. I don't know what the internal arrangements were, but that was a job they gave us. They gave us jobs, the unemployed then. There was a lot of unemployment. Digging up these holes and filling them up again, and to give it for 6 weeks so that we got enough stamps on our cards to enable us to claim a few weeks' benefit. It's the unemployment benefit, which was at that time fairly poor, but it was something that you could pay your rent with and buy some grub. And
did you have any idea that this was right or wrong? Did you feel there should have been a land fit for here, or was it you expected?
Well, you didn't think about that side of it, because everybody was in the same boat then. We were in a very bad state, you know. There was unemployment, was rife everywhere. There was extreme depression. We'd exhausted ourselves. There was all those thousands that had been on munitions had all been discharged. And, of course, this was the picture now in England, and it was just as bad in Germany. And if you had any sense, you'd realise that we weren't the only people who were suffering as a result of war. It was the inevitability of it. Of war any time is always causes this.
Did it make you political at this time? Were you becoming more political, yeah?
Well, I did then because, of course, when afterwards, when I did get a job, I mean, I joined a trade union. I didn't think politically so much about it. I knew there was something wrong, and this was all wrong because it was supposed to be a land fit for heroes, as Lloyd George said, you see. And instead of that, it wasn't the heroes. We weren't regarded as heroes at all. We were more or less an encumbrance to the authorities that had to try and keep things moving and setting right.
What did you think they should have done that they hadn't done to get it?
I hadn't gone into... We didn't go into thinking about that. All we was concerned about, the priority all the time was getting a job. You see, and that was the only thing that mattered.
Did you think they should have helped in that process or what? Did you think there should have been an agency for ex-servicemen to put you in jobs? What sort of thing did you think they should have done?
Well, I joined the... I helped to found the British Legion North West Ham branch in the Romford Road, and, of course, we were that was where the ex-servicemen more or less got together, and that was the only time we talked anything about the war, and then it was mainly war experiences and not political as such. You see, you didn't go into the whys and wherefores of the war. You went into the actual experience, you exchange experiences, and you were there to protect one another's interests as a result of the war being left like this in this position. And you were you were out of work and unemployed in the Legion, but it was a place you could get together and socialise, which was, of course, some sort of compensation for you. At not being in work, and you were commiserated more or less with one another's position. But
how long were you out of work then?
Well, as I say, I got these few jobs down there at the memorial ground, and I think I had two sessions of that. And then I was still, during that time I was looking for work, seeing on the qui vive, and then. My brother, who'd got a job in Tate and Lyles, he got me a job in there in the sugar refinery at Silvertown. It was only a temporary job, you know. You were casual, what they call casual labour. They took you on for a few weeks according to the demand for the sugar. You see, that was then brought over in barges, I had to stand in a box there, and they used to send about half a ton or three quarters of a ton of sugar down out of the pans down onto the floor where there was a moving riddle, and you had to shovel this sugar out while it was wet. And we were stripped except for a blue stripe cotton cover, and you stood in this sugar and shoveled it in. And it, you know, I had my muscles were standing out the back like turnips, you know, all up my back. And I was fit. I could have pushed a bus over. And then, of course, that was only casual as well. I left there. And then what happened then? I joined a trade union, of course, while I was in those places. And then that was in the old General Workers Union, which later was became the Transport and General Workers Union. And and then I got a job as I started taking an interest in politics then, because of the trade union side, it introduced the political side naturally. You paid a political levy, and I wanted to know what I was paying me money for. And naturally, they said, well, obviously you join the Labour Party, and that was the obvious thing then for most of them then. There was very little talk about Liberals or or Conservatives, and it was Labour Party, was the thing to belong to for the workers, unemployed and employed.
When did you finally get a job after this period of unemployment?
Well, the first, the real start I got was with the railway, when in February I got a letter from the engine repair shop where I previously worked, when I was working on the running sheds before I joined up. I had a short period there on the railway. I forgot to mention that previously, but
I did.
Oh, and anyway, I got this letter offering me a start, and I got a job back as a boilermaker's mate in the engine repair shop. And of course, funnily enough, that's where I really entered into serious trade unionism and politics, because I found the engine repair shop wasn't organised. There was 240 men in there, and there was only about 150 of them organised, and they were all types of workers. There were craftsmen and labourers and semi-skilled men, and there was blacksmiths and fitters and boiler mounters and all that. And the secretary who was doing the job, he was a good little organiser for organising people, but he was no good at figures, and he could never make his balance sheet come right, and he very often showed that he'd spent more money than what he'd got. And, of course, there was an annual election, and, of course, an inquiry by the NUR and a query about this, and the boys realised that the election was coming off. And there was a fitter, because we had craftsmen in that branch, Stratford Number 3, NUR, and it was a National Union of Railwaymen, of course. And there was a fitter there who was nominated for the job, and Bob Banks, the one who was in trouble as the secretary, but had put up a game because he'd got some supporters. And I'd come in, I suppose I'd had a lot to say, and I was throwing my weight in to get them organised, because I enjoyed it, and I was intrigued by it. I was quite new to it, really, from that organising point of view. But I'd had one or two things to say, and of course I was in the middle. The third candidate, somebody nominated me, and of course the other two split each other up, and I got in as secretary. And of course I remained as secretary then for another 8 years.
What had given you the motivation to start organising, to start taking a real interest in trade?
Well, they convinced me of the value of unity. This was the secret of it all. And if you're not united, it's like a family. If a family split up, it never achieves much or gets anywhere. It's always a constant friction. But and you can't face a common enemy either. But if you've in my case, of course, I was feeling frustrated. There was that behind feeling that I had over the war, and I was a bit bitter about, it being a land fit for heroes to live in, and then come back and having to struggle like I had, dig up holes and have casual jobs here and there, and really struggling to get established, which should have been made for me, because we were being victorious, we could expect that. But it just didn't work out like that, and nobody seemed to care from the authority sense or government sense. I forget the kind of government that was in then. I think it was about a Liberal government at that time. I don't know, 23, I can't remember. Anyway.
As branch secretary, how did you go about organising the branch and building up, so that you had most of the people in the union? How did you go about that sort of thing?
Well, the first thing I set about was organising the engine repair shop, but for those who wasn't in the union, and except for Holy Joe, he was a chap who was a Christian who used to go preaching. He'd get up on a platform outside the Stratford Works and pray for the Lord and all the rest of it, and he was a lovely bloke, though. He was good-natured, he'd help anybody and all that, but he just wouldn't join the trade union. And when some of our blokes tried to take it out of him because, he was thinking more about Christ than he was looking after himself as a trade unionist and his mates, I used to stop them. I used to say, look, this is a democratic country. If he wants to take up and put religion as priority, that's his lookout. And on those lines, I gathered together. But, of course, some of the awkward ones who wouldn't join up, I must admit, they were very awkward. And, of course, some of the ardent trade unionists, the go-getters sort of members, which you get in every organisation, they came to me and I said, "Bill, what are we going to do about old Bill Jones or Jack Smith or whoever it might have been who was being awkward and they just wouldn't join the union, but they was prepared to get the benefit of it?" I said, "Look, does he use any tools at all?" And they said, "Yes." So I said, "Well, if he can't find any of his tools, what's he going to do?" So I said, "Oh, all right, Bill." And of course, after that, they couldn't. They came to me, although they weren't in the union, they were complaining to me because somebody had been pinching their tools. What was I going to do about it? I said, "Well, you don't belong to the union. I can't do anything for you." And of course, they were soon joined up, you know. It was gentle pressure without putting them out of work or anything like that. But they couldn't get on with their job, and it was piecework, bonus work, premium work, to be exact.
Those are the awkward cases, though. How did you persuade the majority to join? I mean, they were the
Oh, well, I used to argue that unity is strength. And I always pointed, and I followed everything up. But when I took the job on as secretary, I really went into it, you know. And I could count fairly well and do the figure side. That didn't bother me. And I got a nice little commission out of it from the union, which I put in the bank and never touched. That was how it was late. Subsequently, I'll be able to tell you that I bought a book at the co-op with that money when I got the sack, eventually. But apart from that, I used to go around and argue with them logically the value of union. And I used to point out to them the motto on, I don't know whether it's got it now, on the Railway Review. That used to be their official newspaper. And their motto, I shall never forget it, on a scroll on the top of the Railway Review, it always had, "Association is the law of progress." And that struck me, you know. I never forgot it. And I've quoted it time after time to people, you know, even though not apart from the railways, in life generally to trade unionists.
Besides recruitment and keeping the books, what other jobs did you have as branch secretary? Did you act as, were you shop steward as well?
Oh, yes, yes, I was shop steward. And I was... actually chief negotiator with the one I work for, Aurelis.
Is that a separate function? Were you elected as shop steward as well as branch secretary, or was it part of the branch secretary's job?
Oh, no, it was elected. You had to be elected separately because I got pulled up in the branch or charged in the branch because I refused to take a job up early on after I became shop steward. And I refused to take a job up because the man hadn't got a case for me to put. And he was asking for something that was unreasonable. And they couldn't understand, some of them, that why it was I didn't take it up, never mind about whether it was reasonable or not. And I wouldn't know that. And so, of course, they branched me as a shop steward, although I was still secretary. Because I said to them, I said, "Look, if you don't like what I'm deciding, you take it to the branch." And they did. They took it at the branch and they charged me with refusing to carry out a shop steward's job. And, of course, when I explained to them, I said, I decide if I can win a case or not, I've got a chance of winning a case or not, or whether it's fair. And if it isn't fair, you haven't got any right to bring it up, never mind about whether it's the governor or not. And so I took that line and I said, "If any of you want my job, there it is, right away from now." None of them wanted it because they were the hard taskmasters in the railway at that time. You got caught carrying a can of tea or anything like that, it was sack, you know, and there were no meal breaks or anything like that. So in those days, of course, there wasn't paid holidays even, and the only advantage we ever got by working on the railway was privilege tickets, where we were allowed a quarter of the return fare.
How did you go about negotiating with management? What was your technique or what methods did
you
use?
I was very respectful. I've always been respectful. Whether I disliked a governor or not, I'd always give him what I expected from myself, respect. And when I went in there, first thing I used to say to a governor, and this should be the line for all shop stewards, I used to say to the governor, "You're not talking to Mr. Gilman now, you're talking to the National Union of Railwaymen." And I've used that too when I was a transport and general workers officer too, and I went and saw governors. It's always been the same, you know. Well, I didn't use it as an officer because I wasn't working for them, but That is the principle, you see, that if you're elected as a steward for your members, then you've got to prove yourself, you've got to do your job, you've got to play fair, look at both sides and decide whether you can win a case and whether you've got a fair case to or request to make when you're making it, whether it's justified. Not to go up there on some airy-fairy stuff and hope that you're going to frighten the governor into agreeing because you've got a lot of industrial strength.
Did management victimise you at all for your activities, both organising the shop and negotiation?
Well, they used to watch me on my work, obviously. They always do. If they're an active trade unionist, or I don't know whether they do it, I expect they do it now. But we run our own governor, my foreman, the Boilermaker foreman, the one who wrote this letter at the time.
Offering you the job.
Yes, offering me the job because he was the foreman, the Boilermaker foreman. And one day, my job was as tuber's mate, and the tuber was at one side, at one end in the firebox, and I was at the other end cutting the tubes, and we used to knock the old tubes out, put new ones in. I don't know whether you know how a boiler works, but that's how it does work. And, of course, I was actually happy and useful to a lot of my mates too, because I was left-handed as well as right with a hammer, and they used to get me to get one and help me out sometimes. Anyway, on this occasion, my mate called through to me from the firebox, and he said, Bill's old Bisley's watching us standing outside. He said he's been out there for about 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour. So I said, what's he got to watch for? He said, I don't know. He said, that's not right, is it? I said, no, it isn't. We don't want watching. So he said, what are we going to do about it? I said, well, we'll ask him. And I got off the front of the engine, and he got out the firebox, and we went up to him, and Horace always left it to me, I suppose, because I was prepared to say anything, more or less. And he said, Mr. Bisley, is anything wrong with our work, with our job? No? Well, what have you been standing watching for then? He said, I'm the foreman, I can stand and watch anybody I like. I said, well, we don't want watching if we're doing our job. We either do our job or not. And it's steam tight work, and you judge us on results. And we don't want you. And we're not prepared to carry on if you're going to stand there watching us. So he turned around and he said to my mate, Ellis, he said, what about you, Ellis? Do you agree with what he's saying? He said, yes, sir. Because he had to, didn't he? So, of course, he said, I'm not having all this. He said, and of course, we were not friendly after that. And the only other occasion when he tried it on to me, and I went up there on behalf of the lifters, they used to lift the engines out of the frames. And of course, what happened was that they wanted some extra payment for the greasy work. They took it out, they lifted the engines out of the frame, the boilers out of the frames, you know, and then they had to go underneath and perhaps repair an engine frame. And it was filthy work. They were covered in grease, and my trousers I could almost stand up in. And with the grease, you know, and they complained about it, and they said, "Bill, would you? This is what our complaint." They told me, and I said, "Yes, all right. I think it's fair. I'll go out and see Bisley." So I went up and saw Bisley, and he said, "If any of these men have got a complaint, let them come up and see me." So I said, "Well, there's."